Well, this year we have the Parshas of Behar and Bechukosai separate. And, of course, the central themes of Parshas Behar is that of Shemitah and Yovel. And we'll begin at the beginning, read a couple of the psukim, and then see what is the basis for the comments that the Meforshim that we will access make. Well, Perek Kafhei, and almost all of the Parsha really is Perek Kafhei, and Pasuk Beis begins, of course, after the famous Shemitah Behar Sinai. So Pasuk Beis, Daber el Bnei Yisrael, V'amatar Alehem, Ki Savo el Haaretz, when you come to the land, Asher Ani Noseinachem, that I'm giving you, V'shav So Haaretz, Shabbos Lashem. The land shall rest, a rest for Hashem. It should be a Shabbos for Hashem. And we need to ponder the meaning of this expression, a Shabbos for Hashem. After all, presumably, if it's a mitzvah, every mitzvah is for Hashem to the degree that it is. But it's emphasized here that the Shabbos of Shemitah is a Shabbos Lashem. What does that mean? And what is it perhaps coming to obviate? Pasuk Gimel is interesting, because when we read it, it's not clear whether this pasuk is actually telling us any news, or maybe just setting up for Shemitah that comes in pasuk Dalet. What does pasuk Gimel say? Sheshanim tezras hadecha, for 6 years you should sow the field. V'sheshanim tezras kamecha, for 6 years you should prune the vineyards. V'osavta es tubuasa, and gather the produce. So as we noted, this seems to be business as usual. Pasuk Gimel is about what isn't special. It's just a normal year. Seemingly leading up to Pasuk Daled, which tells us that in the seventh year, it's Shemitah. Uvashona Hashvias in the seventh year, Shabbos, Shabbos, Niyala Aretz, who should be a Shabbos for the land. Again, that expression, Shabbos Lashem, Sodcha, Lo Tizra, not to sow the field, Becharmacha, Lo Tizmor. And even in Pasuk Daled, there's room to question. I mean, it's a phrase that we're familiar with, but that's not a reason not to contemplate it. Shabbos or Shemitah is referred to as Shabbos Shabboson. What is Shabbos Shabboson? I think we know what Shabbos is. Shabbos is a rest. But then what is Shabbos Shabboson? A rest of rests? What does that mean? And what does it look like? We're familiar, I think, I mean, the other time that is famous from being called a Shabbos Shabboson is Yom Kippur. Shabbos Shabboson Hulachem. But what is the most helpful translation or rendition of the term Shabbos Shabboson? Shabbos itself is sometimes called Shabbos Shabboson, but what is the meaning of the term? I think in practical terms, or user-friendly terms, if we say that Shabbos is a rest or a Shabbos, then Shabbos Shabboson, I think, is what we would call a super Shabbos. More Shabbos than Shabbos. A Shabbos of Shabboses. But what does that mean? What is the understanding of this? So to summarize, really, and we've read the three psukim, take a note of that which needs to be taken note of. What is the connotation of Shabbos Lashem? What is the contribution of Pasuk Gimel, which is really just describing 6 years business as usual? Is that all there is to it? And what is the meaning of Shabbos Shabboson? And the one who will guide us through these questions this evening is the Sforno. And we know the Sforno's comments are typically brief. So brief, in fact, that if one doesn't take a sufficient note of them, they're over before you know it. And you're on to the next one. Rav Kupperman, my uncle Zatzal, who wrote a Perush on the Meshech Chachma, as is well known, and also a Perush on the Sforno, He said that his goal in writing the two commentaries was exactly the opposite. His goal in writing the commentary on the Meshech Chachma, in his terms, Laman Yarutzbo Hakore, in order that you should be able to go through it smoothly, because it's very difficult otherwise. Laman Yarutzbo Hakore. But when he wrote his commentary on the Sforno, he said his goal was Laman Lo Yarutzbo Hakore, that you shouldn't go through it too quickly, because otherwise the whole thing's finished and you don't know what happened. Rather, you should pause frequently and deeply to ensure that in his few words, we catch what it is that the Sforno is looking to point out and to take note of. So on the words Shabbos Lashem, which is in Pasuk Beis, the Sforno says as follows, three lines. Shetie kol hashana, that the whole year of Shemitah should be habatala me'avodas ha'adama, resting from working the land, should be muchenes la'avodoso, should be aligned towards the service of Hashem. Shabbos Lashem means that when you rest from the land, it should be with the goal of then directing your energies towards service of Hashem. Something that you might not have that much time for, or as much time for, during the working years. Kemosha kiven b'Shabbos Bereishis. And that really, says the Sforno, is a term that's used with regards to Shabbos itself. In the Aseres HaDibros, Sheishis Yomim Ta'avod, etc. V'yom HaShvi'i Shabbos LaShem Elokecha. A Shabbos for Hashem means a Shabbos directed towards Hashem. In the same way that that's what Shabbos should be every week, so too, that's what the Shemitah year should be. After all, if one is not doing something, one can then proceed to do any number of other things. The cessation of work from the land should be geared towards more spiritual pursuits. That's the Shabbos of the 7-year cycle. And according to the Sforno, as Rav Kupperman explains, one can see from Pasuk Gimel that it's really coming to disavow perhaps any other reason that you might think that you have to rest from the land. After all, says the Sforno, there was a common, perhaps still is, there was a common practice, actually, to give the land a rest every once in a while. To let it lie fallow, in order to recoup its strength. And maybe one could say, that's really what Shemitah is about. I mean, you could ask, why do you have to make a mitzvah out of it if it's just sound agricultural practice? But Pasuk Gimel is coming to disavow of such a notion. The land doesn't need our Shemitah. It doesn't need us to rest from it in order to produce effectively. After all, what does the Torah say in Pasuk Gimel? Two things. Sheishonim tizra sadecha. You can sow your field for 6 years. Now, when a field is left to lie fallow, it's never worked for 6 years. If it needs it, it needs it every second or third year. If you have the interest of the field, the productivity at heart, you would never suffice yourself with giving it a rest once every 7 years. It would be once every 2 years, and there would be a rotation every 2 or 3 years. One of the fields gets the year off, and the Torah says, but you don't need to do that. The field doesn't need you to do that in order to give it strength. It's the land of Israel. You can work the land for 6 years. And moreover, the final words of Pasuk Gimel, V'osavta es tevuasa, and you shall gather in its harvest, meaning it will be the same harvest each and every year. And that also indicates that you're not looking to refresh or rejuvenate the land, because it's the nature of fields that need to be left fallow, that the longer you work them, the lower the yield is, the weaker they get with time, which means that the harvest from year 6 would be nowhere near the harvest from year 1. And yet the Torah says, no, v'asavta es tevuasa, you will get the same harvest for each of these 6 years. And therefore, Pasuk Gimel, it just seemed to be describing what we call business as usual. But in fact, I think it's better to describe it as business as unusual. In other words, we're being told that the land will do just fine, even without a break. And if that's not the reason why we rest on the seventh year, then we must turn to necessarily to the reason that we do rest from the seventh year. And that is, as Pasuk Dalet reiterates, that it should be Shabbos Lashem. That it should be a year. It's not so much that the land needs a break from us. We need a break from the land in order to recharge. Just like every year, every week has its seventh day where you need Shabbos to recharge for the week. So every cycle, the seventh year, you also need to spiritually recharge in that way. And this brings us now to a very important question or problem. And one could say that it's a problem that exists, so to speak, with all mitzvahs. And moreover, it will also lead us to an understanding and an appreciation of the enactments of Chazal, of what we call Dinim Derabbanan. And that's a worthwhile pondering and asking. After all, the Torah, one would have thought, has enough laws. Along came the Rabbanan and added more. And what is the goal? What is the goal and what is the role of Dinim Derabbanan? Well, on a simple level, they are protective. In many cases, the Rabbanan added what's called siag l'Torah, a protective fence. So the Torah forbade act A, the Rabbanan then said don't do B in order that you shouldn't come to act A. Siag l'Torah, a protective fence. And that itself is a very worthy thing. Because aside from anything else, it indicates to us emphatically that the Torah's laws are worth protecting. And I recall a number of years ago now, I had the pleasure of being spending Rosh Hashanah with Rabbi Dr. Tversky, Rabbi Avram Tversky, Zatzal. He was then in Efrat, then for Rosh Hashanah. And it was Rosh Hashanah that was on Shabbos. So on day one, there was no shofar. And at the Yontov table, so Rabbi Tversky turned to us and says, you know, if you want to get a sense of what it means to do an Aveira, you need only consider that the Rabbanon suspended the mitzvah of blowing shofar, and the reason that is given in the Gemara is that maybe a person will come to carry on Shabbos. And Rav Tversky began to elaborate and asked, how many people in the history of the world do we think would actually have ended up carrying a shofar on Shabbos in order to find out how to blow the shofar or whatever it is? How many cases would there be across the generations and the centuries? And additionally, the concern is that a person may inadvertently carry, which means that we're actually not even dealing with an intentional sin, but rather with in a moment of forgetfulness, which is not as severe as an intentional sin. And yet, said Rav Tversky, in consideration, in his words, of that Shlemiel who mistakenly, perhaps once in history, will inadvertently carry on Shabbos, it was deemed appropriate to suspend the entire mitzvah of shofar when it falls on Shabbos. Now you know that to do an Aveira, like carrying on Shabbos and so on and so forth, that's how you know that it's a big deal. Those were Rav Tversky's words, and of course, much to ponder there. But there is a further element with regards to Dinim Derabbanan, and the more we investigate, I think the more we'll appreciate. And it begins with the discussion of Rabbi Chonon Wasserman Zatzal, who actually has a treatise called Kuntres Divrei Sofrim, all about Dinim Derabbanan. Of course, in the main, it's Talmudic discussion, very, very involved. But in the end of one of the sections, he raises this question: what are Dinim Derabbanan? What are they looking to do? And he responds by citing a pasuk in the Navi in Yirmiyahu. It's in Yirmiyahu Perek Zayin. It's actually the Haftorah for Parshas Tzav, which we don't always get a chance to say because it's often Shabbos Hagadol. But the Navi is decrying in Hashem's name that people did all these terrible things and they built altars for Avodah Zarah and so on and so forth. And then says the Navi, they did all these things, Asher lo tzivisi, that I never commanded, velo dibarti, and I never told them to, velo ola alibi, and things that I never even considered or wanted. It's a very interesting description of the wrongdoing, and then by implication, we understand the three tiers. There are things that Hashem didn't command, didn't speak about, and doesn't want. And the Targum, on the Navi, of course, is from Yonasan ben Uziel, explains that these three terms, lo tzivisi, I did not command, in the Chumash, in the Torah, velo dibarti, and I never spoke about, through the Nevi'im. And then lo ala alibi, things that I never wanted, it's not in the Torah, it's not in the Nevi'im. What is it? Says Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, that is dinim derabbanan. The Torah is the basis of our relationship with Hashem. And fulfilling mitzvahs is part of what we could call a working relationship with Hashem. In any relationship, there is only so much that is said. But beyond that, even things that are unsaid or unspoken, in the interest of the fullness of the relationship, one will be responsive to what one fathoms that the other side wants. There's something severely missing from a relationship if one only says, what they told me to do, I'm going to do. Beyond that, I'm not interested. If one can only fathom, not only, or from what the side has spoken about, what they would fully, fully want, then that is the full relationship. And I think a classic example, and I believe actually we spoke about this a few months back earlier in the year, is Shabbos. The Torah forbids malacha on Shabbos. Shabbos is a classic example of a mitzvah where it's easy to keep the mitzvah and miss the point. It's exactly the example that the Sforno gave. The Torah says Shabbos should be Shabbos Lashem Elokecha. If you're only guided on Shabbos by avoiding the 39 malachas, you could actually have a normal day. If you're with enough forethought, if you're adept and alert, you can avoid malacha and have a normal day. The Torah forbade doing malacha, it never forbade speaking about malacha. And there's so many other things that one could do which are weekday pursuits, which are not malacha per se. And bring in doing something with the shinoi, and getting someone who's not Jewish to do malacha for you, and groma, which is causing and not doing, before you look around. If you're only organized, you can have a normal business day on Shabbos. And as far as what the Torah commanded, you kept the mitzvah 100%. And as far as what the Torah wants, you missed the point 100%. And that is why when the Rabbanan come in, it's not just quote-unquote to prevent you from doing the malachas. It's to clear the whole area around it, as if to say, the Torah said don't do this, but what the Torah wants is just to put it away. Get it out of the way and get it out of your head. If the Torah says don't do malacha, so don't move things that are related to malacha. And don't talk about things that are malacha. That's the famous v'daber davar, which the Navi speaks about. Mimtso cheftzecha v'daber davar. The Torah forbids to do malacha, and the Navi Yeshaya, who was also one of the Rabbanan, just because he's a prophet doesn't mean he's not one of the Rabbanan, shouldn't be held against him. It's an early din de Rabbanan, is not talking about business pursuits and such like on Shabbos. I don't think Yeshaya HaNavi would have been a great fan of the expression, this Shabbos Garet, unless it's the end of the sentence, but not the beginning of the sentence. Because that get it out of your head. Use the day for other things. And moreover, the positive aspects of Shabbos are all derabbanan. Oneg Shabbos and Shabbos candles and kiddush over wine and lechem mishnah and Shabbos meals and special services and so on and so forth. All the things that make Shabbos special in an active way are all derabbanan. Even people, it's illustrative to consider, even people who are very far from keeping many other mitzvahs and further even from an appreciation of the words of the Chachamim. But if you ask them to name three or four things that they like about Shabbos, all the things that they'll mention will be dinim derabbanan. in spite of themselves, whether they know it or not. Shabbos candles and Shabbos meals and so on and so forth. This is, says Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, to put it in one sentence, the goal of the Rabbanan is in pursuit of the third element of the relationship between us and Hashem, which is called Allah Alibi. Can one fathom what Hashem wants you to do? Not just what he's commanded you to do, and proceed accordingly. If the Torah forbade something, the Rabbanan will add things in order to get it out of your head. And if the Torah commanded something, the Rabbanan will add some things in order to get it into your heart. Make sure that you don't miss the point of the mitzvah. And Rabbi Chanan Wasserman continues and says, if one wants to have a portrayal or a depiction of what life looks like, if you only care what Hashem says, but you don't care at all about what he wants, is there a paradigm for such a personality in the Chumash? There is. It's Bilam. In terms of Hashem's express command, no one is firmer than Bilam. He professes time and time again, I cannot violate Hashem's command. If Hashem, what Hashem does not want, allow me to do, I can't do it. And he really meant it. So what makes him Bilam? I mean, he sounds quite firm. So why is he Bilam Bechozon? Because he doesn't care at all about what Hashem wants. He just has issues with Hashem's command. He won't violate Hashem's command. But if he can only circumvent that, and that's the goal now. Circumvent, or turning a no into a yes. When he originally asks Hashem permission, which is such a strange thing in itself, to ask Hashem's permission to curse the Jewish people, which means obviously he doesn't care what Hashem wants. Hashem clearly doesn't want that. And Hashem says no. Bilam doesn't back down. His goal is to turn the no into a yes. Because the barrier here is not that it's contrary to Hashem's wishes. The barrier is a word called no. If only that can be dealt with, if it can somehow dissolve or disappear or be converted to a yes, as far as Bilam is concerned, he doesn't have a care in the world. No compunction to continue. And the result is Bilam. That's what life looks like, only caring about what Hashem says and never giving a thought to what Hashem wants as the other side of the relationship. We'd like to think that Hashem is responsive to what we want, even if we don't say it. I mean, that's a good relationship. And what's fascinating is, and this Rav Kupperman elsewhere in his writings, and often he would speak about this, the counterpoint, the absolute antithesis to Bilam in this regard, is Avram Avinu. We know that Avram and Bilam are held one against the other. In Pirkei Avos, you've got your students of Avram Avinu with all their benevolent vision and good heart and so on. And then you have your Talmidim of Bilam. They're always considered to be one against the other. And if we say that Bilam is the archetypical individual who cares only what Hashem says but not what Hashem wants, or what he feels Hashem wants, what seems to be, isn't Avram the opposite? What is Avram's outstanding, or of the outstanding achievements, or events, or episodes? It's Akedas Yitzchak. And Hashem never told him to kill Yitzchak. He says, oh, you know, bring him up. When Hashem told him, when Hashem told Avram to take Yitzchak down, Avram said, I'm confused. And Hashem says, I never told you to kill him. I told you to bring him up. You brought him up. You can bring him down. Imagine if Avram took that approach to the Akedah from the outset, and is looking to maneuver and somehow to sidestep or circumvent the express command, there never would have been an Akedah. If Avram had put in all the pilpul, and when Hashem says Haleu, and Avram starts, well, Haleu, that doesn't mean I have to kill him. I can just bring him up and put him down. So there would never have been an Akedah. But look what Avram was prepared to do based on what was clear to him, that what Hashem wants, and that's enough. It's clear that if Hashem said Aleihu, he means as an actual korban with everything that goes with that. And the result is Avram Avinu, light years away from Bilam. And what divides them is that third element, which is called Allah al-Libi. What does Hashem want? A thinking Jew should ask himself that question. They're well versed in what Hashem has said. What does Hashem want? And that the goal of the Rabbanan is to try and uncover that level. And with this in mind, let us come back to the Sforno and Pasuk Dalet, because the one issue that we haven't addressed is why Shemitah is called Shabbos Shabbosim. And here I think we'll see a chiddush in Parshanut. Because Shabbos Shabbosin says the Sforno, Gam mikol machshirei avodas ha'adama, even from preparatory agricultural acts, meaning not actual agriculture. There's so much that goes into getting a field ready. There are so many auxiliary and ancillary things that a field needs, which are not directly agriculture. And the Torah doesn't forbid them. The Rabbanon forbade them. Other ways of developing the field or preparing it. And that's called Shabbos Shabbosim. In other words, the point of the Sforno is, Shabbos means Shabbos. So far, we have translated the word Shabbos Shabbosim as a super Shabbos. But what does that mean? Well, if Shabbos means to rest, then Shabbos Shabbosim means to rest for more than that. If Shabbos means to rest for Melacha, then Shabbos Shabbosin, a super Shabbos, means to rest from more than that. But what else can there be? What else can one rest from if not from Malacha? Says the Sforno, things that aren't exactly Malacha. Give that a rest also. But what is so fascinating about this comment of the Sforno? All those other things, by definition, are Drabbanon. The definition of Drabbanon is something that the Torah doesn't command. But here we have an interface where the Torah says, I'm not going to specify. The things that the Torah specifies are direct agricultural acts. But I'm giving you the goal. You want to get that your Shmita should be Shabbos Lashem, which as we said from the outset means a year that you are free to pursue spiritual goals and spiritual matters. So the Torah has forbidden Malacha, but see to it that it's a Shabbos Shabbosah. See to it that you rest for more than Malacha. Because otherwise you'll just have substituted direct agricultural work for indirect agricultural work. And we'll still never see you in the Beis HaMedrash or in Shul or wherever. So what's amazing is the Torah is here giving a glimpse of what it means to use the time properly. Shabbos Shabbosim. In the same way, this is similar to Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is called Shabbos Shabbosim because Shabbos means resting from work. Yom Kippur, you rest from more than work. You rest from pretty much everything. Eating, drinking, and that's also, it's also resting. Seceding. And so too in Shemitah. So this is the amazing interface pasuk, whereby the Torah has added this word Shabbos Shabbosim so that you can get a sense of what the Shemitah should look like, and the Torah will say no more. You now work out what your Shemitah should look like, what you need to secede from in addition to what the Torah has prohibited in order for your Shemitah to be a Shabbos Lashem. So I think a very, very wonderful analysis of these opening psukim, especially as it's taking note of phrases that don't seem to be unusual or stand out. But if you look at them closely, you'll see, what does Shabbos Lashem mean as opposed to just Shabbos? What is Shabbos Shabboson? And how do the psukim flow from each other? And as we've seen, the matter goes beyond Shemitah. It's about the relationship and the interplay, the synergy, really, between the dinim of the Torah and the dinim of the Rabbanon, as we have seen. Well, moving a little bit further into the parsha, we are met with the famous question of, what are we going to eat? And that is in Pasuk Kaf and Kaf Aleph. So let's read the psukim, and then we will see the question that the Mefarshim deal with. V'chitomu, pasuk kaf, v'chitomu, and if you will say, Manocha b'shana shvius, what are we going to eat in the seventh year? Hei lo nizra, v'lo nesofus tvoseinu, we can't sow, we can't gather in the harvest. So, what are we going to eat? Says the Torah, V'tzivisi, Esbir Chasi Lachem, I will command a special bracha for you. This is the bracha of Shemitah, the bracha for keeping Shemitah, Bashan HaShishas in the sixth year, V'asas HaTvua L'Shlosh HaShanim. And it will provide food for 3 years. Why 3 years? The end of the sixth, the seventh itself, and the beginning of the eighth. And that is that. The very well-known, if you will say, what will we eat? The answer was, there will be bracha, and there will be sufficient food. What's interesting is, as the Mefarshim point out, the question is phrased as, what are we going to eat in the seventh year? The seventh year doesn't seem to be a year that you have the problem. Every year eats from the harvest from the year before. Which means the answer to what will we eat in the seventh year is quite straightforward. The produce of the sixth year. Just like in the sixth year, you eat the produce of the fifth year, and so on and so forth. What we might mean to ask is, what are we going to eat in the eighth year? If the seventh year doesn't produce, there'll be no food in the eighth year. So this the famous question, v'chitomer, if you'll say, manocha bashana hashviyis, should have been manocha bashana hashminis. That's going to be the year where you'll be stuck in the conception of the question. Why then, what is the understanding, therefore, of the pasuk which says, v'chitomer manocha bashana hashviyis? Interesting shaila, simple question. And this question actually is addressed by the Ramban. And the Ramban says, you have to know how to read the Pasuk. I mean, his answer, in a sense, accepts the premise of the question. The year where you might be worried about is the eighth year. So why does it say, Manocha Bashana Hashviyis? Says the Ramban, the words Bashana Hashviyis in this Pasuk, Kaf, are not part of the question. They're part of the Torah's description. In other words, if one could say it in this way, and then we'll see exactly how the Ramban says it, if we could assert or infer quotation marks in the Pasuk. So we understand that the way the Pasuk is to go is v'chitomer, if you'll say, colon, open quote, manocha bashana shviyas, what will we eat in the seventh year? Dot, 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 dot. Until the end of the Pasuk, end quote. But Ramban says no. V'chitomer. And if you will say, quote, manocha, what will we eat? End quote. And when will you say this? Bashana hashviyas, in the seventh year. In other words, according to the Ramban, the phrase bashana hashviyas is not the time about which you are concerned. It's the time during which you voice your concern. You're in the seventh year, so far so good, because we have the product from the produce from the sixth year, but we're already asking in the seventh year, Bashana Shviyas, we're asking, Manocha, after all, we can't work the land. Now one does need to say more. It's already a chiddush. One does need to say more, says Ramban, because the words after Bashana Shviyas are certainly part of the question. Hein lo nizra, we will not be able to sow. We will not be able to gather the harvest. So we're still seemingly in the voicing of the question. And that's why the Ramban says one needs to invoke here the concept of mikra mesuras. Mikra mesuras means sometimes the Torah will have the phrases not in the order that one needs to infer them for whatever reason. Mikra mesuras means one needs to move for didactic purposes the later phrase earlier. It's as if it says v'chitomu bashana hashviyas. If you will say in the seventh year, manochal, what will we eat? Hein lo nizra, etc., etc. So in other words, to be clear, for the Ramban, bashana hashviyas isn't part of the speech bubble. It's not part of the quote, but it's in between two parts of the quote. It's put there for a reason, but for the syntactic understanding, it should be read as if v'chitomer bashana hashviyas, if you say in the seventh year. This is the approach of the Ramban. It is a chiddush, but Ramban is capable of saying chiddushim, and the concept of mikra mesuras is a well-known concept. Obviously, one needs to know how to use it. But that's Ramban's response. A much later response is to be found in the commentary of Rav Hirsch. And Rav Hirsch says, and one could say it's a straightforward, in the most positive sense of the word, explanation. And that is, says Rav Hirsch, you know, it's true. If every year you're working the field, so if it's the seventh year, you eat the produce of the sixth year, and you're fine. But if you're not working in the seventh year, if you're not working the land, which means you already anticipate that there will be no food in the eighth year, so then your concerns actually begin already in the seventh year. Because all you have is the produce of the seventh year, which needs to tide you over for the seventh and the eighth, given that you're not working in the seventh year. Meaning, a shortage of foods in the eighth year would already impinge on the seventh year. And you already might be worried that you won't have enough food for both years. So then your worries begin, actually, in the seventh year. Manocha bashana hashevius. Even for Rav Hirsch, it's not that you're only worried about the seventh year and not the eighth year, but you are already worried about the seventh year, given the fact that in your conception, the food that you have currently in the seventh year needs to last you for 2 years. And other Mefarshim in a similar vein, as soon as there's no, you project that there will be no food in the eighth year, you already feel that you don't have enough in the seventh year. I mean, it's often your relationship with the present is a function of your projection of the future. I mean, lahavdil, it's like sometimes people are at their hungriest at the very beginning of the fast because they can't eat anymore, even though they couldn't eat anymore even if they wanted to. But it's that conception that that's it until further notice. And actually, at the end of the fast, often people aren't that hungry anymore. They're only not hungry because they could eat whenever they want because the fast is over. So the future really does impose on the present in all of these directions. So what we've seen so far, again, to be clear on the question, the time stamping seems to be a year early. The Pasuk seems to be asking, what will we eat in the seventh year? Whereas the real question is, if the seventh year doesn't produce, what will we eat in the eighth year? And we've seen Ramban, and we've seen Rav Hirsch. But there is a fascinating approach to this question, completely unexpected. And it comes from Reb Chaim Berlin. Reb Chaim Berlin was one of the sons of the Netziv, and he was at one time the Rav of Chief Rabbi of Moscow. Later on, he moved to Yerushalayim. Of course, a very, very special person. And Reb Chaim Berlin, he actually doesn't address this question of Bashan HaShavias, but when we see what he does say, it will answer the question as well. When we ask, what will we eat when there's no food? The Torah says there'll be a bracha for 3 years. And we cheshbend out the 3 years that it will be end of the sixth. You know, the harvest of the sixth will be for the end of the sixth, the seventh, and the beginning of the eighth. Now, it happens to be that once every 50 years, we're actually looking at an even bigger miracle. And Rashi advises us about this. Namely, before Yovel. Because the Yovel year follows the Shemitah year. Which means that in once every 50 years, you have 2 years in a row where you don't work the land. If that's the case, then the blessing from the harvest before those 2 years is actually a blessing for 4 years. The end of that year, and then the Shemitah year, and then the Yovel year, and then the beginning of the post-Yovel year. So that's very interesting to consider why the Torah itself wouldn't give voice to the much bigger miracle, once every 50 years, of blessing for 4 years. Describing only, I mean only, everything's relative, but you know, quote unquote, only the relatively smaller miracle of blessing for 3 years, leaving it to Rashi to lead us to the Yovel year and say there could be a blessing for 4 years. That's an interesting question. Why did the Torah not give us the biggest miracle of Shemitah and Yovel combined? The harvest will see you through both of those years and beyond. But there is a second question, and this is a compelling Parshanut question. Sometimes Parshanut comes from scrutinizing the pasuk in front of you or the phrase in front of you, and sometimes Parshanut is about surveying the whole flow of the psukim. You see, if we would consider Parshas Bahar from the beginning, we could divide it into three sections, or certainly where we've gotten to so far. Number one, section one, is Shemitah. And that is from which we discussed quite a bit in the beginning of the shiur this evening, and that is Perek Pasuk Aleph to Pasuk Zion. Those first seven psukim are Shemitah, and that is that. Adkan, the first topic. From there, we move on to Yovel. Count 7 years, 7 years, seven times, and then it's Yovel, and then the various halachas of Yovel. And that is from Pasuk Ches to Pasuk Yud Gimel. Thus far, the second topic. So far we have Shemitah and Yovel. Then, in Pasuk Yud Dalet, we move on. I mean, it's related, but we've moved on from Shemitah, moved on from Yovel, and we're talking about how to sell fields. You shouldn't overcharge, you shouldn't undercharge, it should be, it goes according to the harvest, etc. Okay. So these are the three topics in these three sections respectively. Section 1, Shemitah. Section 2, Yovel. Section 3, sales. And lo and behold, Pasuk Kaf seems to take us back to the very beginning. It's like we didn't finish talking about Shemitah. Now you may be wondering, what are we going to eat in the seventh year? You know, it's a good Shaila, but isn't it a good Shaila in the first seven Pesukim when actually the topic at hand is Shemitah? Why is it that this isn't raised there? That should be its place. That's a very interesting Shaila. We've waited to shift topic and then we come back. We bring ourselves back to Shemitah. And that is why Reb Chaim Berlin says, and it is a Chiddush, others say it also actually, I saw this week the Chassam Sofer says as well, but Reb Chaim Berlin says that actually the question that is voiced in Pasuk Kaf relates to sale of fields. It's not a question about bitochon as we normally think of it. You may be wondering, what will we eat, etc. It's actually a question about the sale of fields. Why? Because as Pasuk Yudala tells us, you only ever sell a field until the Yovel. So when you set what's called selling a field is only really selling it for the number of harvests until the Yovel. Per year, such and such an amount. No more, no less. Okay. Which means if you want to know how should I rate the price of a field if I'm selling it? The answer is, see how many years there are to Yovel, and then each year is whatever its amount is, and then the number of years, there's your price. That's really the message of these, of the Pasuk, Yudalad, Tetzvav, Tetzayin, etc. There's just one Shaila, which you may be asking. Namely, one out of every 7 years, there's no harvest. So, if I'm paying per annum because it's per harvest per annum, and then once every 7 years there is no harvest in that annum, so why should I pay for that year? Here we are saying, make the cheshbon of the years, and each year should have a certain price. Why should I pay for it? Why should I pay for a non-practicing year? For a non-working year? It's a good shaila. Right? What's the Shemitah year doing for me? It's not a harvest year. So why should I pay for that year's harvest? It's a good shaila. But you know what the answer is? Pasuk Kaf Aleph, b'tzivis yes b'chasi lachem. No. You do pay. You know why? Because the sixth year has a double blessing. So don't look upon the seventh year as I'm paying for nothing. It's not true. In every 7 years, there are seven harvests. Because there's double in the sixth. It's like Lecha Mishnah. That's the answer to the question. So it does require you to pay for that year. So in other words, this is a Choshen Mishpat question. This is about sales. You know why you pay for that year? Because there's a harvest in that year. It doesn't come in that year. It came together with the year before. But you have a harvest for per every year on average. That's why it's discussed here in the Halachos of Sales and not actually back there in Shemitah. And moreover, says Reb Chaim Berlin, that is why the Torah never spoke about the Yovel year, where there's an even greater miracle where the harvest gives you for 4 years, for the simple reason. At the Yovel year, the sale goes back. So it's never a Shaila, why am I paying for the Yovel year? You don't. Yovel is when the sale terminates. You only pay for the Shemitah years. And that's why the question is only voiced with regards to that. a classic comment of Reb Chaim Berlin in so many ways, paying attention to where the pasuk is, what it says. And for our purposes, I think this may also explain to us why the question is phrased as Manochal Bashana Hashviyas. What will we eat Bashana Hashviyas? It's not about in the seventh year. In the seventh year, you'll eat the harvest from the sixth year. Manochal Bashana Hashviyas is what do we eat with the seventh year, through the seventh year. I mean, the seventh year doesn't do anything for us. Why should we be paying for it? Manocha Bashana Shviyas. How is the seventh year a working year? The answer is you get double blessing in the sixth year. So these are some of the responses to that disarmingly simple question, because the pasuk is so well known to us. Manocha Bashana Shviyas. Why the focus is on the Shana Shviyas and not the Shana HaShminis. Well, together with Shemitah, as we know, we have Yovel. Shemitah is every seventh year, and then every seven sevens, you have the 50th year, which is Yovel. There is a discussion, actually, in the Mishnah, in fact, as to whether the Yovel year is a 50th year, so then they're really, the cycles go in 50 years, or maybe the 50th year is actually the first year of the next Shemitah cycle. It's Yovel, it's different than other years, but the cycles are yet in 49, with the Yovel being the first year of the next Shemitah cycle. Be that as it may, I'd like to take a look at Pasuk Kaf Gimel. And again, there's many psukim about how the sales go. No sale is permanent. And the Pasuk Kaf Gimel phrases it in the following way. Okay, Perek Kafei, of course, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. V'ha'aretz lo timachel litzmisus. The land can never be sold permanently, says Hashem. All right, I don't allow you to sell the land permanently. Ki li ha'aretz, because the land is mine. Ki gerim v'toshavim atem imadi. For you are sojourners and dwellers with me. Ki gerim v'toshavim atem imadi. And there is a very interesting comment of the Teras Kohanim on these words. Gerim v'toshavim atem imadi. You are sojourners and settlers with me. And the Teras Kohanim says, we both settle the land to the same degree. You're there to the same degree that I'm there. I'm there to the same degree that you're there. We settle the land together. We are, that's to say, we are settlers, or dwellers, more correctly, in the land together. But what does that mean? So one of the classic commentaries on the Teras Kohanim is from Rabbeinu Shimshon of Shantz. Rabbeinu Shimshon, one of the great Balei HaTosfos. And Rabbeinu Shimshon explains that what Hashem is saying is, we have this notion that Hashem dwells in the land of Israel. That's obviously, it's a mystical concept, but it's a very central one. Hashem dwells in the land of Israel. Along comes the Teras Kohanim in explanation of the Pasuk and says, yes, to the extent that we do. Hashem says, I dwell in the land together with you. The more you are there, the more I'm there. This is now the concept of, as Rabbeinu Shimshon himself expresses, the idea that when the Jewish people go into Golus, Hashem goes into Golus with them. Shchinta Begalusa, it's a Gemara in Megillah, it doesn't use that term, but Hashem goes into Golus together with the Jewish people. So when they're dispossessed, he also leaves with them. But when they come back, he comes back with them. To what extent does he come back with them? To the extent that they come back. To what extent is he there? To the extent that they're there. In other words, what the Teras Kohanim is revealing to us is that there are really two concepts in Hashem's relationship with the land. There are two concepts. One is called ownership of the land, and one is called residing in the land. Hashem's ownership of the land and Hashem residing in the land. And what we're being told is Hashem's ownership of the land, obviously, is constant and unwavering. That special connection in terms of the land coming from him, belonging to him, that's unwavering. That's not dependent on anyone. But Hashem residing in the land, what we call Hashras Hashchina, that depends on the Jewish people. The more they are there, the more he is there. And why is this said in a pasuk that relates to Yovel? It says Meshach Chachma for a simple reason. The halacha states that the Yovel year only applies when all the tribes of Israel are in the land of Israel. Ukrasem deror ba'aretz lechol yoshveha. The laws of Yovel apply lechol yoshveha, as the halacha states, you need all the 12 tribes of Israel to be there. And why? Because it's only when all of Israel is there that Hashem himself is, quote unquote, fully there. And that's when the dinim of Yovel apply. That's why it's spoken about here. Because Yovel is an example of a mitzvah which requires the presence of all 12 tribes, of the entire Jewish people, representation of the entire Jewish people. And to pick up on this and develop, and to add, perhaps, what are we saying? We're saying, I believe, that this is really the key difference between the mitzvah of Shemitah and the mitzvah of Yovel. The mitzvah of Shemitah does not require all 12 tribes to be there. The Kedusha of the land needs to be activated for mitzvah Satelios Ba'aretz. But you don't need everyone to be there for Shemitah in the same way that you do for Yovel. And I believe that really what is emerging here is that the two mitzvahs of Shemitah and Yovel, they reflect the two planes of relationship between Hashem and the land. In terms of Hashem owning the land and therefore giving us the land, that's the mitzvah of Shemitah. Hashem as the owner and giver of the land is constant and unwavering. So as soon as the Kedusha of the land is activated, Kedusha HaMitzvahs, there's a mitzvah of Shemitah. Yovel is not about Hashem's ownership of the land. It's about Hashem himself dwelling in the land. That doesn't happen until all 12 tribes are there. So the mitzvahs of Shemitah and Yovel respectively are these two ideas: ownership and residence from Hashem, so to speak. That's really what's happening. And I believe if in Kenim Advarim, if this is correct, and I think it is, this may give us insight into a pasuk towards the end of the parsha. That is in Perik Kafhei, pasuk. It's the final pasuk in the parsha. And what does it say? Eshabso saitishmeru. Keep my Shabbos and fear my Mikdash. I am Hashem. And understandably, we will be inclined to ask, what does this have to do with Shemitah? Ma inyan this pasuk, it's all Shemitah. We should not be, I wouldn't say misled, but we shouldn't be thrown by the fact that it's considered to be described as the beginning of a new chapter. I mean, the chapters, as we know, are not divided based on the Jewish sources. It's the end of Parshas Behar. As far as we're concerned, chapter 25 shouldn't have 55 psukim in it. It should have 57. Rabbis were not consulted when chapter 26 began, two psukim before the end of Parshas Behar. But what is it? What is the meaning? How does this form the conclusion of the Parsha about Shemitah and Yovel? Keep my Shabbos, fear my Mikdash. How is it relevant here? And what accentuates the question, or intensifies the question even more, is that this pasuk actually has already been stated word for word in Parshas Kedoshim. Literally the same pasuk. Eshabso saitishmeru umikdashi tiro ani Hashem. I'm not aware of how many examples, if there are any examples, of this in the Torah, where you have a pasuk like that, which is literally word for word repeated. So what does it mean? But the Ibn Ezra has a fascinating explanation of this pasuk. Ibn Ezra says, what's the parsha talking about? Shemitah and Yovel. And you know what this final pasuk is talking about? Shemitah and Yovel. How so? The two phrases, Shabso Saitishmeru, keep my Shabbases and fear my Mikdash, says the Ibn Ezra, es shabsov sai tishmeru is shmita. Why is shmita called Hashem's Shabbos? Because it is, as we saw at length from the Sforno, the beginning of this year. It's Shabbos Lashem. And as shabsov sai tishmeru, unlike the pasuk 2 weeks ago in Kedoshim, which was talking about Shabbos, here we're talking about the second type of Shabbos. Shmita. And what about Umikdashi Tirau, fear my Mikdash, says Ibn Ezra, that's Yovel. Now, I think we'll all agree, it's a little easier to understand how one can call Shmita Shabbos, because it is. But why are we calling Yovel Mikdash? But based on the Taras Kohanim, as explained by Rabbeinu Shimshon, and as elaborated on further by the Meshech Chochma, I think we understand why Yovel is called a Mikdash. A Mikdash is where the Divine Presence resides. Now, obviously, the epicenter of the most concentrated form, to the extent that we can talk about it in that way, of the Shekhinah, is the Beis HaMikdash. That may well be. But what is the Pasuk saying? Yes. The Beis HaMikdash is the most concentrated center of the Divine Presence. But if the entire Jewish people are in the land of Israel, they can elevate the land so that the entire land, on a basic level, is also called Mikdash. Because what is Mikdash if not where Hashem resides? And do we not just say that Hashem says, Geirim v'toshavim atem imadi? We reside together. If you're there, I'm there. So if the 12 tribes are there, if the Jewish people are there, so the Shekhinah is there. And if the Shekhinah is there, the land becomes a Mikdash. And if the land becomes a Mikdash, certain additional halachas come in once every 50 years. The fields go back, slaves go free. What are those, if not responses to the presence of the Shekhinah, the real, the ultimate owner, who's here? So the field goes back. It's an amazing perspective, I think, on the Yovel year. The Yovel year is a response to the status of the land of Israel as a Mikdash on a fundamental level with the mitzvahs that come in. And it's very interesting that the Yovel is activated on Yom Kippur. There is no greater time when one communes with the Shekhinah than Yom Kippur, where the Kohen Gadol goes to the Kodesh HaKodashim. The Kodesh HaKodashim is the innermost point in the land of Israel. It's the most intense expression of the Divine Presence. But on that very day where the Kohen Gadol connects with the innermost point and actually emanates outwards to the entirety of the land of Israel, the whole place is a Mikdash. You have an amazing harmony between the epicenter of Kedusha and the ultimate Hispashtus HaKedusha, the expression of Kedusha. So I think it really is an eye-opener, this Taras Kohanim, very, very striking, as explained by Rabbeinu Shimshon and the Meshech Chochma, because what we're being told here, the extent to which we say the Shekhinah is an Eretz Yisrael, it's not a static thing. It's not a set thing. It's dynamic. And it's responsive, and it's responsive to the Jewish people. And certainly during these times when the topic of Eretz Yisrael very much in the forefront of our minds, which it always should be, so to hear an idea like this, certainly we look forward to the time when the Jewish people, as the Jewish people, will return to Eretz Yisrael, and we will be living there, Hashem will be living there, the land will return as a Mikdash, with all of the tzoros that are a symptom of the absence of that status. V'nos yogon v'anocha, mishibuzocha te geulas olam, mibimeheir b'yamein amin.